Support for Radio Catskill comes from Two Queens, offering coffee, tea, and bees. Located in Pete's Plaza, Narrowsburg, New York. TwoQueensCoffee.com. And from listeners like you.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. And if listening is an act of love, as some have said, then storytelling could be the first step to resolving many conflicts. On this episode of Peace Talks Radio, correspondent Sarah Holtz speaks to three storytellers who lift up the voices of individuals who share a goal of promoting peace within their own communities. We begin with Tanika Lewis Johnson. In 2017, Tanika began taking photographs of residents on the north and south sides of Chicago in an effort to portray the city's segregation. Those photographs sparked dialogues between the residents, and Tanika's work became the Folded Map Project, a community storytelling series that confronts systemic inequalities through peaceful discussion.
The conversations, to me, served as a great model for the larger public to understand how simple yet awkward these conversations can be. Because just asking someone, how did you come to live in your neighborhood, really gets to the heart of the issue of segregation and how people, regardless if they're on the beneficiary end of, you know, segregation or part of the group who's most negatively impacted by it.
Yeah, and could you explain for us what it means for two people to be map twins?
They are map twins because if you were to fold Chicago's map at its zero point, which is downtown Chicago, because Chicago is on a unique reticular grid, the neighborhoods that would touch my home neighborhood of Inglewood are those north side neighborhoods of Edgewater, Rogers Park, and Andersonville. So that is why they're map twins, and that is how the map folds, by having those map twins actually meet and talk to each other, which is something that segregation prevents from happening.
So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how the Folded Map Project came about in the first place.
The project idea for Folded Map started as a seed of an idea when I was in high school as a freshman, a 13, 14-year-old who had to commute from my South Side Inglewood neighborhood 15 miles north to go to high school. And I went to Lane Tech High School. And it was on that daily commute that I started to really see the difference between how my neighborhood looked and the neighborhood that my high school was in. And in addition to those observations of how my neighborhood had vacant lots, abandoned homes, liquor stores, and the neighborhood my high school was in didn't have those things. They had cafes, boutiques, no vacant lots, all the homes were lived in. That kind of stuck with me. And the primary thing that I was introduced to was the fact that the streets that existed in my neighborhood also existed in the neighborhood that my high school was in 15 miles north. And I just thought that was fascinating because I would ride the train and I would think like, oh my gosh, like Ashland Street does not look like this in Inglewood. Walcott, Palina don't look like this in Inglewood. And that just stuck with me. And so that's when the seed of the idea was born. And it pretty much took the rest of my life after that to really understand and learn and figure out how what I was observing impacted my daily life today. And it ultimately came down to me understanding that it was due to historic racism and segregation.
So our show centers around nonviolent conflict resolution, and it seems like these conversations between the map twins are kind of a perfect example of that. But I'm wondering, did conflicts ever come up that you saw, and how did you see them get resolved?
It wasn't even really conflict. It was more so being introduced to a different perspective. It was literally people sharing their perspective of their neighborhood with each other. And everyone self-selected to participate. So they were open for this kind of possible conversation anyway. And there was really no resolution necessary because the ultimate resolution that occurred was the listening. And when you listen to someone who you're visiting, you know, going to their house to talk to, you are naturally kind of disarmed. And it allows for you to become empathetic in a way that you wouldn't listening to a news report or reading some report about disparity and segregation. Like being face to face with someone in their neighborhood, in their home, describing to you why they like their neighborhood, the issues with their neighborhood, or not even having those answers. It just provides an opportunity for a different kind of understanding or awareness that really isn't a conflict. And so all of their conversations, you know, reflected that. There were questions that were obviously interesting and difficult for some to answer. People made mistakes trying to verbalize their preference for certain things in their neighborhood. And in any other setting, it could have been offensive. But in order to even learn how to talk about this, you're going to make the ultimately infantile mistakes of saying things wrong. But everyone was open to being corrected. And so that's the space I think Folded Map offered for people who were really interested in having this discussion and amplifying the complexities of talking about segregation and disparity to people who have a different lived experience than your own.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think it's so important right now, as we are so isolated just by how we're spending our days, that you're providing this opportunity to engage folks on this very deep and personal level.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think it's a level that is required now. Because it's very clear that litigation, policy, laws, protests alone haven't gotten us to where we want it to be. And for me, the missing ingredient to make all of those other critical ways to make change in a society, protests, laws, policy, would be more impactful if we included the personal aspect. If we amplify the movements of solidarity across racial lines that have occurred throughout history, if we look at those as possibilities of how we can make change for the future and really understand that populations don't just have to live separately and vote their way out of, you know, an inequitable city, state, or country. It means more when you connect with others and you become more empathetic, you become more aware, you become more knowledgeable, you become more understanding, and you figure out ways to disrupt these large systemic issues in your own personal life. And those things are important. Those things are what contribute to movements. Those things are what contribute to you meeting other people that you might not meet because of segregation, that you could actually have a wonderful friendship or connection and relationship to. And all of those things are necessary if we want to advocate for those who are most negatively impacted by our country's inequity. And there are people who are privileged that care. You know, and there are people who are most negatively impacted by segregation that have solutions, but just don't have the platform to amplify those solutions. And that's why connecting across racial and geographic and class divides are important, because there are people in each of those divides that could work well together. And that's what we need for change.
You can hear more from Tanika Lewis Johnson, founder of the Folded Map Project in Chicago, either in the hour-long version of our program or in the complete conversation Sarah Holtz had with her at our website, peacetalksradio.com. Look for our March 2021 episode. Next, Sarah speaks to an artist and human rights defender named Adriana Camarena. Adriana tells stories about the connection between police brutality and gentrification in the Mission District of San Francisco. She also leverages her legal background to support community members facing discrimination and other injustices. Adriana calls this process accompaniment.
I am by training an attorney, a Mexican attorney. I don't practice here in the U.S., but I do use my legal background in various ways. And one of them I have found is to do this community work of accompanying families that have a lot of gaps in their ability to engage institutions, such as trying to engage supervisors or lawyers or the DA, and trying to understand how this justice system works here. And this is, for me, particularly important with a population like the Mayan community or first-generation immigrants, where they already probably, because they got here, were probably highly discriminated in their homeland as well.
And related to that accompaniment, could you talk about the altar that you helped to create for Alex Nieto, the young man who was killed at the hands of the police in 2014 in San Francisco?
So I am from time to time attracted to figuring out what other ways to talk about a story that engages people differently, perhaps even more emotionally. And also, Elvira and Refugio, they have been manual laborers all their life. And so they have a very good instinct about materials. And we created a video that was with Yvonne Iriondo. And that video was shown on a small kind of old TV. And we recreated a living room for the installation. And that living room was soliciting the fact that Alex Nieto, actually his bedroom was the family living room. And in that space, we brought out his uniform, his night guard uniform that he was wearing when he was killed by the police, and some other beloved artifacts. But also we brought out his gravesite. I brought rocks from Bernal Hill and put them in installation to create, similar to what you find in the hill even today, a community altar for Alex that is built on rocks and crosses and flowers and mementos. And together that created an environment of being in the living room and the parents. I took a photo of Elvira and Refugio after we installed, just sitting there. And so I think that's very poignant of what these families live with. You know, they go back home and they have these spaces where their beloved family member used to interact with them.
Wow. And I'm thinking about these different forms of grassroots support and how your work accompanying families kind of ties into that and ties into how a community can begin to heal in a way.
My intent in accompanying the families is so that they feel, first of all, accompanied, that they're not alone, that they don't have to do this alone, that they, because they probably still have to go back to work and they have to take care of their grandchildren, and that we can walk this together. And another thing that I'm always interested in is helping, doing things that help heal their trauma. And this might happen in different ways. This might be because they're invited to and they want to join in a big direct action, you know? And sometimes seeing how many people show up for you and try to share that story with you is intense and memorable and fills you with courage, right? There are other more intimate moments, like creating that altar with the nietos, which I also have to say, Elvira was so proud of it. So proud of it, because Alex Nieto was a young man involved in his community, and he loved Chicano art and Chicano art culture and the culture of the mission. So for her to be able to do that for her son was special and memorable. I think about it, honestly, as a little grain of sand that we're just tossing into a pile. But as we saw this year in the middle of the pandemic with the rise-ups around the George Floyd killing, it was the drop that spilled the glass, right? And so I think that's, if you can call that peacemaking, that's part of what I do.
Yeah, and I think the storytelling element of your work is so important too.
Yeah, and I think in that regard, I think what we're also trying to create is opportunity. One of the things I learned from the Alex Nieto case and accompanying his family was that we might not win the legal case, but we will win the story. And it's important to win the story because then you create opportunities. But just this last week, a collective of organizations worked to put together a series of recommendations to the city about compassionate alternative responses to homelessness, where you take police out of the picture, and we're suggesting, recommending that a new nonprofit-based new group be created to respond to specific situations where the police have no business attending unhoused people. That's an opportunity that was created through a lot of work, not just our own, but a lot of work around homelessness-related issues, housing issues, anti-police brutality, and absolutely working off of that moment in the past year when people rose up to demand a different type of response to conflict in society.
That was Adriana Camarena, a San Francisco Bay Area artist and human rights defender. Her community journalism series is called Unsettled in the Mission. You can hear more from her either in the hour-long version of our program or in the complete conversation Sarah Holtz had with her at our website, peacetalksradio.com. Look for our March 2021 episode. Today, Sarah Holtz is having conversations with women who are applying their artistic and academic and storytelling skills to help achieve social justice where they live. We conclude our show with Harriet Hendel. She teaches restorative justice and hosts a podcast called Pursuing Justice for the Innocence Project of Florida. As part of her educational work, Harriet has mentored many incarcerated individuals serving long sentences. To begin the conversation, Sarah asked Harriet how this work began for her.
It began way back in the 70s when I took my master's in learning disabilities and discovered that the rate of illiteracy in prisons is so very, very high. Begins in juvie. They come in with an inability to read or a disability where they were never taught properly to read because of their disability, their handicap. And so it begins there and then winds its way through adult prisons. So I promised myself then that if there was an opportunity sometime later on, that I would take my skills into a prison. But the opportunity never arose until 2006. So that was a long space in between my master's and then. And I ended up living literally around the corner from a maximum security prison for 2,400 men.
Wow. And was it difficult to convince the prison administration to let you start teaching there? How'd you do that?
I called and asked the warden if I could come and volunteer. They weren't all that eager to have me there because I think the teachers were a little threatened by me. I don't know why. But eventually, after pushing for almost a year, they said, okay, you can come and teach. And so that, I think, is the beginning of this journey, which was very different from just being a teacher of children who had learning problems for 30 years. And so I ended up teaching 20 men in each class, three classes each morning. I was there 3 days a week. And it was so rewarding to me to work with them. And what I was actually doing was helping them pass the essay portion of the GED. And my approach to them was to read to them out loud excerpts from books I felt they would be able to relate to. And because most of the men sitting in front of me were African American, I chose things like Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, Henry Louis Gates's book, all memoirs. And the reason for that is because I wanted them to understand that the pain that they were carrying around, and all of them had a story, could be used in a positive way. And along the way, I discovered a book that was edited by the author Wally Lamb, and the book was written by the women in a women's prison in Connecticut. These were stories and poems, and I thought they might like some of those. And I read a story by a young woman named Robin Ledbetter. The men loved her story so much, they encouraged me to write to her. And I said, well, but I already wrote to Wally Lamb and told him what a great job he did with the women, because he was running a writing class, kind of like what I was doing. And they said, no, that isn't what we asked you. We asked you to write to Robin herself and tell her that we loved her story. So they shamed me into it, and that is exactly what I did. And then I waited 4 months until Robin answered me. And the reason that she didn't is she had just tried to hang herself in the shower and end her life. Robin had come into prison at 14 and was given a 50-year sentence, no parole, meaning that she would be up for parole at age 64, not a day before. But because of Bryan Stevenson's attempts at changing the way we treat juveniles and the kind of sentencing we give them, things changed over time, and those sentences are no longer constitutional. So we ended up going to see Robin eventually when she kind of came through a very major depression and said she would like to meet us. And we drove 3 hours up to her prison and continued to visit her for the last 11 years. So we kind of adopted her. So as a result of that story of hers, we established a wonderful, wonderful connection to her. And she is now waiting for release by the parole board in Connecticut, and she has served 25 years of that original sentence.
That's unbelievable. And I know from when you and I first spoke over the phone that Robin's involved in a program at her prison that sort of models itself after some prisons in Germany. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
We learned that her prison was doing an experimental program for 18 to 24-year-old women. And the approach was based on Germany's prisons, which the governor of Connecticut had gone to see himself. He was curious to know what they were doing that was so different from us, and what they are doing is very, very different from our approach. And the approach is a very humane approach, where these men who have been convicted of some extremely serious crimes, we are not talking about check forging, have a key to their own cell. They can decorate it any way they want. They go to work off the prison grounds and they come back voluntarily. They can go home for the weekend and come back voluntarily. So the tone of those prisons is certainly set at the top by the warden, but the guards treat the men as human beings, and they actually say so. There are some films about Governor Malloy's trip there. So when he came back, he decided to pick two prisons to try to change the culture inside those prisons. And he has. He's no longer a governor, but he has done a magnificent job. And Robin's prison is the beneficiary. So right now, Robin is a mentor in this program, and it's called the WORTH program. WORTH stands for Women Overcoming Recidivism Through Hard Work. And she is very proud of her leadership role and the staff. She doesn't refer to the guards anymore as guards. She calls them staff. They work together collaboratively. That was never true before, never. She was Ledbetter, and that's the way they spoke to her, by her last name. Never addressed by her first name. And just that alone has made such a difference. But the idea is, if one of the women in the program is having a bad day or does something that's very unacceptable, instead of punishing her or sending her into isolation immediately, which would be the case, Robin and the staff member come over to her and sit down with her and talk to her and say, what's going on today? What's happening with you? And so this program certainly has changed the lives of the young women, but to me, more important, it has changed Robin's life. And Robin has said that she felt her own life had no value whatsoever, none. But now she sees clearly the impact that she has had on these young women.
Wow, that's really powerful. And I think in general, with all of the restorative justice related work that you do, you figured out a way to take these stories and share them in a way that impacts people on a personal level, even if they don't know anyone who's incarcerated.
That's what is the most important thing, is to be open to reading and listening to people's experiences and stories, and trying to educate people who maybe wouldn't care about this topic. Maybe. And then if you tell them a personal story, or you have someone on your program who has their own story to tell, and that story changes someone's mind, then you've accomplished something. And I think it comes down to changing one mind at a time. I think if you do that, you've done a great deal.
Harriet Hendel, a restorative justice educator working largely in Florida. Her podcast is called Pursuing Justice. You can hear more from her, either in the hour-long version of our program or in the complete conversation Sarah Holtz had with her at our website, peacetalksradio.com. Look for our March 2021 episode. Also, there is a donate button to click on to help support the work of our own nonprofit organization, which produces this program and brings it to you separate and apart from whichever station or platform you hear it on yourself. Although we certainly hope you'll support those outlets too. In addition to support from people like you, we also get help from the Albuquerque Community Foundation Ties Fund and other generous family foundations that continue to support us. Thanks to KUNM at the University of New Mexico for its years of support as well. Nola Daves Moses is the executive director of Good Radio Shows Incorporated, our nonprofit organization. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Sarah Holtz, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening. And thanks for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
Support comes from Nonetta and Friends Creative in Barrieville, New York. Pottery studio and art gallery offering group and private classes. Handmade ceramics and art in the gift shop. Currently featuring holiday sale group show. NonettaandFriends.com.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Two Queens, offering coffee, tea, and bees. Located in Pete's Plaza, Narrowsburg, New York. TwoQueensCoffee.com. And from listeners like you.
WJFF Jeffersonville. We are Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Never Sink General Store, featuring an award-winning chef,
smoked barbecue year-round, local products, and catering. Now offering takeout. Never seen